session number 24629, Real Talk.
While we were in Gibraltar, we used to sneak over the border and fill up all our empty bottles with sherry. We would sneak back again. Now, the Spanish were neutral, and they entertained a lot of German spies and things like that. Every time we went through the Straits of Gibraltar, there would be a chap sitting there with a telescope counting us and telling us, but we knew he was there, and he knew what we knew. And we used to take the full bottles of sherry back on board, then pick up another convoy and come back to Goa, and then pass the sherry on to Bessie, you see. It was quite a lucrative drink, but she paid us quite well. And we used to dine out on it occasionally. Anyway, that was sort of the illicit trade we used to carry out. And I was the gunnery officer of that ship, and you see, I didn't specialise in any particular branch of the Navy. I was what they call a salt horse. And I wasn't specialised in navigation or gunnery or communications or anything like that. So I could do anything that the captain decided I should do. And in this particular case, I became the gunnery officer. And we had one 4-inch gun, you see, besides some Oerlikon guns, small stuff. Now, the 4-inch gun was there to clobber a sub that came up and then surfaced. And also, because I was a gunnery officer, I was the boarding officer of the submarine. Now, if a submarine came up and the crew, came on deck and was making signs of abandoning the submarine, I would go across in a boat, and the first thing I had to do was to chuck a chain down so they couldn't shut the hatches, and also throw a stun grenade down. Anybody down the bottom there threatening to shoot anybody that came down, which was me. And so I never actually had to do it in real life until after the war, when the German submarines were coming up and surrendering at the end of the war. And then I had to do it on 2 submarines. Well, it was rather different doing it because they were surrendering anyway. But it was interesting in so much that you could tell by boarding a submarine as to how well it was run and who was running it. And one submarine was run by a Nazi, and his submarine surrendered in a shambles. Everything was there that shouldn't have been there. I mean to say, all the code books and things like that, and all the equipment, etc. And everything was, nothing was smashed. I mean, so he could have got rid of the German crew, cleaned it out, and used it the next day, as a submarine. The other submarine was obviously run by an Imperial Navy, a Prussian, because he had discipline. And you could see it in his bearing when he surrendered, and his crew were much more disciplined too. And everything in that boat that he went on board with the Prussian commander was wrecked, and should have been wrecked by the other guy. We couldn't have used that submarine. It was afloat, and that was all. It was a hull, and it was no good to anybody. Which is the way you should surrender a vessel. And his crew were much more disciplined and better. The others were scruffy, ill-disciplined, and arrogant. That's the training. There were 2 different navies, really, we were fighting. Interesting, but there they are. Anyway, having sort of spent my time in Leeds Castle and the war coming to an end then, I was...
How did you celebrate the end of the war?
Well, We were in Dock, in Gun, which is Dockland of Glasgow. And we heard the end of the war announced, and that night the place went mad. Everybody was switching all the lights on, and everybody was dancing around the streets, and everybody was getting very drunk. And we blew our siren and sent a very pistols off and various other things. Captain was away on leave, so it's fortunate. We were then seconded to doing, after that, weather reporting duties. Also, being a safety vessel for the American troops that were flying home. The Americans used to fly were flying their troops home in a lot of flying fortresses that they'd used during the war over here, and they were flying them back. Now, every so often, they used to like to have a ship underneath them, and they would clock in with this ship, flickering, and they would say, XYZ, passing over, and so we tick them off as they were going by, see that they were okay on their way. Now we used to do that for 3 weeks at a time, and we had to stay stopped in one position. It gets a bit boring, just sitting in the sea, wallowing around. So we used to do various things to amuse ourselves. One was, we closed down to one boiler, and thus we could go, say, 6 knots on one boiler, and then we could flash the others up if we wanted to. So we'd stop at night in our position, shut down, and everybody, if the weather was reasonable, have a good night's sleep. We'd drift off during the night with the tide and wind, etc. In the morning, we'd check our position and then steam back to our proper position where we had to be, then stop again. Well, to entertain ourselves, we decided to have a shooting contest. So I got the shipwright to build a target, which was about the size of that sofa, a bit bigger, and we would tow this astern, you see, with a target on it, that was fine. Then came the question of, well, how are we going to see how well the fellows were shooting? How would we mark the target? So that's where seamanship came in. We lowered the whaler, you see, and we would tow the whaler on a line and the same length as the target. Now, when we were shooting, the whaler would put its rudder over and steer out away from the target. You see, the ship going slow ahead, and so we used to steer out. Five chaps were shooting, which was a team of five, and they would stop, and then we would go in alongside the target and mark the target and cross out where the bullets had landed.
What were they firing with?
303 rifles. And we would put the score down, and then we'd clear out again, and the next lot would come up. It was quite interesting, quite good. And so we used to do various other things like that.
Did you have, as an officer, a sidearm pistol?
I had a pistol, yes.
What would that be, Webley?
That was Smith & Wesson.
American?
Yes, the ones I had. But they were just as good as any gun I'd ever, not my great authority on guns. But we were taught on pistol range how to fire these things, and not, point them like that, but to fire from the hip by pointing your body at somebody. Like, if you wanted to indicate somebody, you would do that, you see. Well, you, instead of doing that, you pointed your gun. Some were good at it, some were bad at it, But quite good. But the best weapon I used to carry in the event I had to board a submarine was a Verrys pistol. You see, a Verrys pistol is quite a small gun, and you can stick it in your belt, and you fire it, and it shoots the star out. Now, if a star hits somebody, that person is going to be very painful before he dies.
Phosphorus, isn't it?
Yes. And so he, you know, it's quite a good weapon to have, particularly it took place in the case of pirates trying to board you, which that was after the war. That's out in the Far East. It's quite effective to fire a Verrys pistol at somebody or at a boat.
Did you think that you might be sent to the Far East? Or?
Well, I mean, say, I didn't think about it really. It's, you know, one went where one was told to go. You know. I went out to the Far East after the war, when I was still in the Navy, and also when I left the Navy. But this is after the war when I was the first lieutenant of an aircraft carrier. And we went out of the Far East, and we in Hong Kong, we were looked after by a side party. A side party is the party that looks after the outside of the ship and does all the painting and everything, etc. And these were all girls, Chinese girls. And Grandma was in charge of the side party. And the only thing Grandma wanted in way of payment was all the gash, all the garbage. And she would take that away, and what she did with it, fed her pigs on it or whatever it did, I don't know. But she was very good. I was the first lieutenant, therefore she was responsible to me, and I had to the outside of the ship to look after, amongst other duties. And we had Chinese stewards on board that ship, and you get the Far East, you quite often do. And I had a Chinese steward who looked after me extremely well. But as soon as she came on board, she dismissed the Chinese steward, and I was being looked after by her, you see. In other words, I was being told what to do by her, because she used to come and see me with a cup of tea in the morning, when I turned out, and with the Hong Kong Times, and would tell me what engagements I had that day. She got hold of a copy of Daily Orders and obviously found out what Daily Orders and what affected me, and would come and tell me what I was doing. And so she would lay out the various uniforms I had to be put on for certain things. And at seven bells, that's 11:30, every day her little sampan would come alongside, and I'd get into it, and she would row me round in her sampan and what the work she'd been doing on the outside, see? Now, she was quite a girl, this granny, and I was talking to her one day and asked her what she did during the war. And she looked at me and smiled and said, "Japanese ships need painting." Yes. So, she obviously did the same for the Japanese, too. But, and the only time I... it was quite an honour, in so much that she invited me to go and have a meal with her one evening. And that was in her home being a big junk. And it was a lovely junk too. I mean to say, spotlessly clean, lovely, comfortable, and all her family were there. And I just wondered what I was eating, but whether it was the gash from my own ship or what, I don't know. But it was a very good meal.
Which aircraft carrier was this?
Hermes. And it's the, it was the ship that got built three times. I was standing by her up in Barrow, And she got built so far up to the flight deck level, and the staff requirement, see what happens when a ship is built, you go, the Navy say what sort of ship they want, all singing, all dancing, capable of doing this. The planners, the Royal Corps constructors, then look at it, you see, and they say, well, if you wanted to do 45 knots, you've got to cut down on something else, you see, because we can't have a ship this size doing 45 knots with all this equipment in it, you see. So you come to a compromise, which is not exactly what you wanted, but as good as you're going to get. And in the course of building a ship, which takes about a couple of years, I mean, so the whole process takes 7 years, but a couple of years to build it, actually physically build a ship. The ship, the staff requirement changes, and new inventions come in, and things like that. So they built Hermes up to a conventional flight deck, which was full and half. And then somebody thought of the angle deck, you see. So they strip it down again to the main deck level, then build it up again with an angle deck, you see. And then somebody else thought of a scoop bow, you see. So they built a scoop bow. So it took quite a long time to eventually get that ship out of the maker's yard. And it was a very good ship when it eventually came out, and did very well.
How long were you on her?
2 years.
From which date?
That was, what date was it? I think it was, I must have been ahead of Ocean, the first class carrier that I had, but Hermes was 59 to 61, just the end of 61.
And which ships were you on between the end of the war and...
Well, at the end of the war, I was, as I say, in Leeds Castle. And then I was... they started to pay some of us off. The R&BR chaps sort of left, and so ships were put into reserve. I had volunteered for... to join the RN if I could, you see, because at the end of the war I looked around my own shipping company, and that's the New Zealand shipping company which I was supposed to be going to. They said, well, we don't know exactly what our size of fleet we're going to have, because they'd lost ships, their officers had been prisoners of war, and they didn't know what officers were going to come back to them or not. So they said, well, if you get a chance to get them join the Navy, go and join the Navy, you know. So that's how basically I left the Merchant Navy, as it were, and was concentrating on trying to get into the Navy, which I eventually did in when I was serving in HMS Vanguard, which is the last battleship we ever had, in 49. I was accepted into the RN. But in the meantime, having left the Pincher, I was then sent out to the Mediterranean in a troop ship to join HMS Ocean, and that was an aircraft, an operational aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean. Now, I'm not an aviator, but I was travelling out with a lot of other aviators or aviator airmen, and they thought that I was an aviator as well. So when we got to Malta, there was a naval lieutenant who came on board, and who was a transport officer, who said, you're all going to Hal Farr, you see, which was an aerodrome run by the Navy in Malta. So I said, well, I'm not an aviator. And he looked at it, oh yes you are, you're in this party. And I said, well, I'm not an aviator. And the others say, oh come on, you'll have a good time out here. Come with us, you see. So I went along with them. Got there, and the commander air, there was a commander of the base and a commander in charge of the airmen and the flight, you see. The commander there said, oh, we have a Harvard that you can take some flights in, you see, and keep your hand in and do a bit of practicing, because the ship was still at sea and not back for, I think, 10 days. So, I used to...
Yeah, you were telling me about HMS Ocean.
Yeah. HMS Ocean, yeah. She was a light fleet carrier. And it was a good commission in the Mediterranean, because it was peacetime, and also allowed a lot more freedom, places to go, etc. I used to play hockey, and although I say it myself, I wasn't a bad hockey player, and used to play various teams, like the French team of Algiers and various other places and this, that and the other. And I remember one occasion, why it sticks in my mind, I don't quite know, but I think it was the French attitude. We had a surgeon commander called Fritz Gerald, who was also a good hockey player, and he was playing centre forward, and I was playing centre half. And I passed him a ball which was coming across the field, and he picked it up on his left hand side, flipped over his head, and he hit this ball with his hockey stick inside the D before it hit the ground on the other side. So he had a very good eye for a ball, you know. And this ball went like a bloody cannon, and it hit the crossbar above the Frenchman's head. And he didn't like it a bit. Was speaking voluble French, and eventually rumbled off. And they had to get a substitute to come and play in goal. But what sticks in my mind is this Frenchman leading off about how dangerous hockey is, and also how some mad Englishmen are shooting balls at him. That was great. Anyway, that was a silly story. But it was quite fun in the Mediterranean in those days, and we had Maltese stewards. And of course, the Maltese can make themselves understood anywhere in the Mediterranean, because their language is a mixture of all the languages of the Mediterranean. And they're very useful, because if you're in Turkey, of all places, and you're going down the bazaars, and some Turkish carpet bazaar fellow tries to sell you a carpet for about three times its actual value price, the Maltese could pick it up and would quietly tell you, don't deal with him, sir, he's trying to cheat you, you know. And so I always found the Maltese very interesting people. I haven't been back to Malta for ages, but I don't know. Are you a Roman Catholic, by any chance?
No, I'm not.
You know. Well, what I'm going to tell you then won't hurt you, or won't offend you. In Malta, there's a club called the Salima Club, which is an officer's club, and occasionally we used to have a dance there on Saturday evenings. And it was a very good dance, very good show. And we used to know a lot of the local Maltese families. A helicopter came somewhere. But anyway, this particular occasion, we had a first lieutenant called Sir Marshall Warmington, and his lady had a very nice family heirloom pearl necklace. And she woke up on Sunday and couldn't find her necklace. And she, you know, could have sworn that she had taken it off the night before and put it on her dressing table. But she couldn't find it anywhere. And Marshall sort of went back to the club to see if they found any necklace, and this, that, and the other, and they hadn't. Anyway, some days later, he was dining with the Shakuna family, and the Shakuna family are quite a big family in Malta. Anyway, they said to him, having heard his story about this necklace, they said, "Have you asked the Archbishop?" And Sir Marshall, not being a Roman Catholic, said, "Why should I ask the Archbishop? You see, I've been to the police and all this, that, and the other, but I haven't been to the Archbishop." They said, "Well, it's quite often that things are found and handed into the priesthood, you see, and you might ask the Archbishop to see if there's any trace of this necklace." So, in the meantime, Marshall had advertised a £500 reward for this necklace. So he went to see the Archbishop, and the Archbishop gave him an audience and said no, he hadn't heard any necklace being handed in, and this, that, and the other. He said, but he would make inquiries amongst his priests to see if anybody had heard anything about it. Well, about 3 weeks later, the Archbishop sent a message to Marshal Warrington saying, would he come see him? So he trundled along to see the Archbishop, and the Archbishop said, "I think I found your necklace." "Oh," says Marshal Warrington, "that's very nice. However did you find it?" He said, "Well, it was handed in, and I was told by one of the priests that this necklace had been handed in, and didn't know whether it was your necklace or not." And he said, "I think from your description it is your necklace." And then he said to Marshall, he said, "Before I give it to you, you did say there was £500 reward." Yeah, and there were £500 reward to get his necklace back. Mm. And that is the only problem, I think, with Malta, really, is the church are so dominant. They don't do anything without the consent of the priest, which I think is not a good thing. I mean, say they don't think about having children without the consent of the priest.
So how long were you there?
Well, I was there at that time 2 years, on and off.
So that was on Ocean?
Yes, and then I came home from Ocean and joined Anson because for a second commission.
Which was which date?
Which was in 1949. But I was only there for sort of 9 months because I was doing a training job. When I came home from Ocean, I was sent on leave. And then I had to, after a certain length of time, leave. I had to go and report to my appointments officer in the Admiralty, you see, who was responsible for appointments of lieutenants. And he said, "Well, there's a job going in Anson." He said, "I think you've served in Anson before." And I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you know Anson then?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, she is one of the training ships in Portland Harbour." "Right, right." I said, "What's the job?" And he said, "Well, I've got a file here," and he produced a file about that thick. He said, "Go and sit in next door where it is empty, read it, and then come back to me and tell me if you can do it." So I trundled off with this file, not knowing what the hell it was all about, and started reading. Now, they thought up a scheme in the Admiralty to get commissions to national servicemen who should be commissioned into the RNVR, as it was in those days. Now, it was a way of recruiting for the volunteer reserves, really. Now, so they picked out certain national servicemen to be, and sent them down to me. I arrived on board the Anson and said, "I come to train these national servicemen." The commander said, "Oh, have you?" And he said, "I know nothing about this." And I said, "Well," I tried to explain to him what it was about. And he said, "Oh, well, what staff do you want?" So I sort of picked the staff and got an office and a mess for the trainees, and the first 15 arrived. Now, they were a very interesting bunch of young men, because they were well educated, and they were on their way to universities, obviously, and they, you know, were quite keen to, they knew it was a new scheme, they were quite keen to do it, but at the same time, they were going to have some fun. And so I don't know. Now,